Mommy, mommy, come and look and see what I have found. A little way away from here while digging in the ground. Come away, Melinda, come in and close the door. It's nothing but a picture book they had before the war.
This is Alan Chartok. In the studio with us today is Dr. Lawrence Wittner. Lawrence Wittner was born in 1941 in Brooklyn, New York. He attended Columbia College, the University of Wisconsin, and Columbia University, where he received his Ph.D. in history in 1967. Since then, he's taught at Hampton Institute, at Vassar College, at Japanese universities under the Fulbright program, and at the State University of New York, Albany, where he is currently professor of history. A former president of the Council on Peace Research and History, now the Peace History Society, has written extensively on the history of peace movements and on the history of the United States foreign policy. He's received major fellowships or grants from the American Council of Learned Societies, the MacArthur Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the United States Institute of Peace. His books include Rebels Against War, Cold War America, American Intervention in Greece, The Struggle Against the Bomb, A History of the World Nuclear Disarmament Movement. The first volume of One World or None was published in 1993 by Stanford University Press and was awarded the Warren Kuhl Prize of the Society for Historians of American Foreign Relations as the outstanding book on the history of internationalism and or peace movements. The second volume, Resisting the Bomb, was published by Stanford in 1997. The third volume, Toward Nuclear Abolition, A History of the World Nuclear Disarmament Movement, 1971 to the present, appeared in August 2003. He's also edited three other books and written more than 100 articles and book reviews. A longtime participant in the peace, civil rights, and labor movements, Lawrence Wittner also performs instrumentally and vocally with the Solidarity Singers at peace and social justice gatherings. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
Well, it's good to see you. You're a scholar, of course, and a very productive scholar. And SUNY at Albany should be very proud to have you as one of theirs. I have to ask you, though, do you come with a Weltanschauung, with a worldview, with a prejudice?
Well, I wouldn't call it a prejudice. I have my values, as I'm sure you do, and I think most people do. I care deeply about some things, and you've mentioned them. I care about workers' rights, and so I've been involved in the labor movement. I care about world peace, and therefore I've been involved in the peace movement. I care about racial justice, and therefore I've been involved in the civil rights movement. I don't see anything wrong with that. And indeed, as academics go and historians go, I think we all have our own positions. Now, obviously, we do our best to write good history and to tell the story as we see it.
So what is the story? I guess the first question I want to ask, because this is a brilliant book, Toward Nuclear Abolition, the first question I want to ask is this. How close do you really believe we've come to just annihilating ourselves?
Well, I think fairly close. The problem, as I lay it out in this book and the first two volumes of the trilogy, is that the bomb, nuclear weapons, are part of the international system. That is, just like earlier advances in military technology, moving from spears to bows and arrows to guns to cannons to battleships and so on, the world has moved to the nuclear age, an age where we now have nuclear weapons that can destroy the world. And unfortunately, those advances in science and technology are put into this system that has been functioning for thousands of years of competing territories that are fighting it out, that used to use swords and bows and arrows, but now are willing to use nuclear weapons. And therefore, I think that the situation has become very dangerous. And indeed, many politicians and national leaders have told us just that, that it is a very dangerous world. But since they perceive the danger as coming from other nation states, they're willing to arm themselves with nuclear weapons and in certain circumstances even use them. And what that means is that unless there's some restraint on these national leaders in terms of popular pressures, they're going to use nuclear weapons, and indeed did use them as soon as they had them. What's very striking is they were developed in the context of the Second World War. And as soon as the United States had the bomb, it used the bomb. And the real question is, Why hasn't it used a bomb since 1945? Why haven't other countries that have developed nuclear weapons used a bomb since 1945? Why haven't most nations of the world developed nuclear weapons, even though they have the scientific and technological capacity to do so? And I argue in these three volumes that it's been popular pressure that has restrained them. Because if the nation-state system, if this old competition among nation-states really could proceed unhindered, they would have used the bomb since 1945.
Do you think there was something so special about ending that Second World War that the use of a nuclear weapon was justified?
Personally, I don't. I think that the war was grinding to a halt in any case. The Japanese war machine was clearly defeated. U.S. military leaders at the time were in fact saying that we don't need to use the bomb. We can do it with conventional forces.
Probably at least a million American GIs would have died.
Well, that's the claim made by supporters of the use of the bomb. There's no evidence to sustain that argument, it seems to me. The military planners of the time didn't say that. That was said later by President Truman in his memoirs in justifying use of the bomb. But the planners, the war planners, the military men who should have known what kind of casualties would have ensued, said that was not the case at all. They had much lower estimates than that. And a number of officials in the State Department and the military said that if the Russians entered the Far East War, which they had not done up to that point, that the war would come to an end quite quickly. In fact, it did come to an end quite quickly, although that was after the bomb was used, and therefore apologists for use of the bomb could say, well, it came to an end because we used the bomb. But it was also true that there had been a major war in the Far East up to that time, and the Japanese were defeated by that war, and the Russians entered the war at that point, and that was a severe psychological blow to the Japanese leaders.
And you suspect that the reason, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that the reason we used the bomb was to keep the Russians at bay?
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think the United States used the bomb pretty much for the reasons I outlined in terms of nuclear dangers, namely the fact that new weapons are always used by nation states, or at least always used in the past, and they had this great new weapon of war. And frankly, most U.S. political leaders didn't see anything wrong with using the bomb. The notion that the bomb should never be used, that a nuclear war should never take place, is something that developed after the anti-nuclear campaign began, after the bomb was used. Before the bomb was used, only a very few far-sighted individuals, some atomic scientists, for example, and so on, could foretell the disaster that would overtake the world if nation states just plunged forward with nuclear war. So I think the bomb was used thanks to the fact that the assumption in warfare and in dealing with other nations has always been that you use weapons to win the war, and that's why they did it.
We're talking to Lawrence S. Whitner, Larry Whitner, who wrote this brilliant third volume, Toward Nuclear Abolition, A History of the World Nuclear Disarmament Movement, 1971 to the Present. So, you should be interviewing yourself because you set up the next question, and that is fascinating. It's been used twice in a war, but it hasn't been used since.
That's
why not?
Correct.
Why not?
Let me go back a step for you. When I began this study in 1986, my conclusions as to the power of public pressure on governments were fairly pessimistic. That is, I thought governments did pretty much what they wanted to do. At that time, they had ignored the nuclear freeze movement, it seemed to me, and yet this was the largest grassroots movement of modern times in the United States. They had ignored the upsurge of popular protest in Western Europe that had drawn millions of people into the streets that seemed likely to affect politics, and yet it didn't seem to affect politics at the time. And I felt that the nuclear arms race was going on. So I began with a conclusion that nation states, that national leaders did pretty much what they wanted to do when it came to foreign and defense policy questions. What I began to find when I plunged into the government documents, what I began to find when I interviewed government leaders, what I began to find when I poked deeper into the historical record, was that they had been influenced, but in more subtle ways than that. That is, they didn't give up the bomb. We still have nuclear weapons with us today, although fewer than a few decades back, that they didn't give up the bomb, but they had accepted nuclear arms control and some measure of disarmament. Now, you might ask, why would they do that? Why would nation states that had historically developed as many weapons as they could to secure their national interests as they viewed them on the world scene, why would they ever limit themselves in terms of the weapons they had built to secure their national interests? And the more I did probe into the historical record, the more I found that they were responsive to upsurges of popular protests against the nuclear arms race.
Can you give us an example of one interview you did with one important official who indicated that to you?
Sure. For this last book, Toward Nuclear Abolition, I was interviewing many figures from the Reagan administration, since there are very few historical records one can go through for the recent period, for the Reagan years. Only about 3% of the materials at the Ronald Reagan Library can be viewed by scholars at this point. I had seen a few things in the library that indicated how seriously the government took the nuclear freeze campaign. For example, I found telephone calls or records of telephone calls made by Ronald Reagan, written up in his own hands on forms, in which he had actually phoned members of Congress, this congressman from Nebraska, this congressman from Indiana, and so on, pleading with them to vote against the nuclear freeze resolution in the House. So it was clear to me Reagan took this very seriously and the administration took this seriously. But when I talked to administration officials and asked them about it, they frequently said, oh, no, we didn't take that seriously at all. That was nothing. We just brushed that off. We knew we were right and we were going to get peace through strength and so on. And then I got to Robert McFarlane, who was Reagan's national security advisor, or one of them, during his presidency. A fairly nice fellow. I got on reasonably well with him, although we didn't have quite the same views. But he seemed like a man of integrity. And so after I asked him a few easy questions, which is how you begin interviews, of course, I popped him the more difficult one, and that was, how did you folks respond to the nuclear freeze campaign? How seriously did you take it? And he said, oh, we took it very seriously. I said, oh, really? Is that so? You know, what did you do? And just at that moment, his secretary buzzed him and reminded him that his next appointment was coming up in about 15 minutes and so on. And I froze at this point, and I thought, oh, gee, now that I finally smoked them out on this, and now that I've found someone who's willing to talk about what they did and how seriously they took this, he's going to say, sorry, I have this next meeting coming up. But to my great joy, he responded to the secretary, oh, tell Mr. So-and-so that I'm involved in this very important interview at this point, and we can reschedule for my other meeting with him.
Wow.
And I thought, great, got him. And at this point, he went on to describe the campaign that they began in March of 1982 against the freeze campaign that McFarlane coordinated, that involved bringing in representatives of the CIA and of the Department of State and of other government agencies and sending them out on the road to campaign for the administration's policies and so on and so on. A major campaign that went on for the next year. Furthermore, McFarlane told me that they began to modify their nuclear policy. That is, it wasn't just their campaign to counter the freeze that showed how serious they were about this and how much of a threat they viewed this as, but the fact that U.S. nuclear policy that had not been committed to arms control and disarmament. I should remind you here that Ronald Reagan had never supported a single nuclear arms control or disarmament treaty negotiated by any of his Democratic or Republican predecessors. Suddenly, the Reagan administration began to talk about nuclear arms control and begin to come up with proposals that involved either restraining the arms race or getting rid of nuclear weapons. And it became clear to me through that interview and others that I conducted that the administration had given way not just rhetorically, but on the policy front as well.
And you think this is cause and effect with the peace groups that were out there?
Yes. I mean, they told me this. Yeah. Richard Perle, for example,
sure,
who was a leading hawk in the Reagan administration at that time and also plays
a
somewhat similar role today in the Bush administration, Richard Perle told me on the phone, and I interviewed him on the phone, although I was with McFarlane personally. Perle told me on the phone that when it came to a strategic nuclear weapons, the administration had to have a nuclear arms control program because it was being pressed hard in Congress in terms of funding for the administration's strategic nuclear weapons program. On the MX missile program, for example, almost didn't make it through Congress at all. And in fact, in the end, it did make it through with only 50 of the 200 missiles proposed, which was not an enormous number. And indeed, the peace movement at the time was very happy. It was lobbying very hard and working with the Democrats in Congress very hard to block the program. And it came away viewing this as a victory. But to get even those 50 missiles through, the administration had to begin a strategic arms talks. And after all, there was no reason they had to have talks about getting rid of strategic arms. Why not just build them? Right? That's what nation states had done in the past. They had built weapons. They didn't talk about getting rid of weapons and so on. So Perle said, well, of course we had to bargain with Congress. We had to begin to get serious about a strategic nuclear arms control measures.
There are those, some of the right-wing press, without naming any particular New York tabloid, who would paint the peace movement as fifth columnists, lefties. But in your book, you take issue with that. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The Nuclear Freeze Campaign, which was the major campaign in the United States that developed during the early 1980s, was created by Randall Forsberg, who was a strategic defense analyst who worked in Cambridge, Massachusetts, had nothing to do with any left-wing group. And when she developed the idea, she wanted this to be a mainstream movement. And in many ways, she made it a mainstream movement. She continued active with the Freeze campaign for years after that. And she saw to it that it went for the center of U.S. politics rather than for the left, although it is true that liberal Democrats became the strongest proponents of the Freeze campaign in Congress, people like Senator Edward Kennedy. But also they got on board Senator Mark Hatfield, a Republican of Oregon, a rather peace-oriented Republican, I should add, but a Republican nonetheless. And they actually got this through the House, and they had very substantial strength in the Senate. This Freeze campaign was endorsed by the Catholic bishops. It was endorsed by every mainstream religious denomination in the United States. It was backed by dozens of labor unions. It was backed by the AFL-CIO. It was backed by virtually every professional association in the United States. So while for a brief time the Reagan administration, like other conservative and right-wing groups, seized on the idea of labeling this as some kind of red campaign developed in Moscow, it was so clear it was not that for the most part the mass media just brushed that aside. And furthermore, inside the administration, the CIA and the FBI, which were asked to investigate this and the anti-nuclear movement overall, reported to the administration that really this was a mainstream movement that had nothing to do with the left wing. It had nothing to do with the Soviet Union.
How do you know that?
To do with the public's. Well, all I can say is there were investigations conducted by the FBI and the CIA, which after all worked for the Reagan administration. Mm-hmm. And they reported to Reagan, according, for example, to Robert Gates, who was the deputy director of the CIA at that time. And he states this in his book, I think it's called From the Shadows. And he states that we told a very skeptical Reagan administration that they were simply wrong and they should drop this. This was silly. And indeed, there were closed hearings that were held by Congressman Boland of Missouri during that time on the Freeze campaign. And the FBI reported to the committee. And the FBI, according to Boland, simply said that the Freeze campaign was not a left-wing subversive movement, but a mainstream citizens' movement.
So when the declassification of some of the KGB documents, I'm sure you must have taken a look at some of this, came to light, was anything in there that was compromising the peace movement?
No, nothing. Actually, I haven't seen KGB documents, but I have seen the records of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing there that would indicate any Soviet control or financial support for the Nuclear Freeze campaign or for its counterpart in Western Europe or around the world. I should add here that, of course, there was a communist-led peace movement, and that was headed by a group called the World Peace Council. And they had a very tiny branch in the United States that had about 1,000 members during these years. But when I conducted interviews with the nuclear freeze people and others who were involved in the mass citizens movement and mass citizens lobby against the bomb at that time, they pointed out, and indeed some of the leaders of this U.S. Peace Council, which was the U.S. branch of the World Peace Council, all said that they had no influence on the nuclear freeze campaign, that the nuclear freeze campaign actually shunned them, and they were very unhappy about this fact that they felt they should be recognized for zealous campaigners for
peace. Well, they probably shunned them because they didn't want people saying that they were communist infiltrators in the movement.
Well, all right. It was partially that they just felt this would stigmatize the movement, and they were trying to build a mainstream citizens movement, as sure. they did. But it was also due to the fact that they didn't have much respect for the World Peace Council. The World Peace Council was the voice of the Soviet Union. It sounded like Pravda and Izvestia most of the time. It was blatantly one-sided in favor of the Soviet Union. It backed Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. It previously backed Soviet intervention in Hungary in 1956. So the leaders of the non-aligned peace movement, of this mass peace movement in the United States and the world, really didn't want anything to do with what they viewed as a phony movement, as a movement that didn't stand for peace, that was just a bunch of cheerleaders for the Soviet Union and Soviet foreign policy.
And in fact, you make the point in the book, if I remember, at some point in which you say that the communists were unhappy that they couldn't control.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yes. And in fact, what's shown in various files, especially in the files of the Stasi, that's the former dreaded East German secret police that were supposedly doing all kinds of nasty things, and I think did many nasty things during these years. The Stasi files, which I have seen since that government has collapsed and its records are available to researchers, although I don't think anybody else has ever gone through their files when it comes to peace movements. What the Stasi files show is that the Stasi and the East German government hated this mass non-aligned peace movement, because this mass peace movement was as willing to criticize Soviet and East German foreign policy and military policy as it was to criticize U.S. foreign policy. Their view was that the nuclear arms race, whether conducted by the East Bloc or the West Bloc, was a bad thing, was unhealthy for all living beings, and therefore should be brought to an end. And the Stasi, like the World Peace Council, had a very different view. Their view was that the Soviet Union was the paragon of world peace and human progress, and therefore any criticism of Soviet foreign policy was objectively helping the imperialists, meaning the United States and Great Britain and so on.
Larry Wittner is professor at SUNY at Albany. His book, Toward Nuclear Abolition, A History of the World Nuclear Disarmament Movement from 1971 to the Present, has been published by Stanford. It's the third in a major trilogy. My hat's off to you, Larry. I can't believe the work that has gone into all of this. And
well, thank you, Al.
About a third of the book is just reference material.
Right.
which is extraordinary. So this is not some sort of fly-by-night exposition that's coming out of your head. You really have done a lot of work. And I think people out there would love to know how you do it, but I'm not going to give you that chance yet.
Okay.
Let's talk a little bit about something that just leapt up from the book. Not only the power of people getting together and saying, no, this doesn't make any sense, and we're really going to insist on it, but the question then of what one human being could mean to all of this. For example, you have the most fascinating insights into Gorbachev and what his contributions. And then there's a sort of interesting look at Reagan himself, because on the one hand, you know, we know how he started.
Right.
But by the end, I think you were being a little bit more sympathetic to him. And so I'm sort of wondering about what the impact of a single human being on the course of history can mean. Let's start with Gorbachev.
Okay. It's certainly true that if one looks back at the end of the Cold War, at the development of nuclear arms control and disarmament policies that reversed the dangerous nuclear buildup what one former Secretary of Defense told me was the crazy direction things were moving in at that point. I think Gorbachev deserves a good deal of the credit. Certainly, he was determined to bring the Cold War to an end. He was determined to end the nuclear arms race. He was determined to channel Soviet and world energies into what he felt would be a more a productive course for human life on Earth. And he did that. On the other hand, it's also true that he did that in the context of a worldwide movement and of public opinion that basically backed that movement, that didn't like the nuclear arms race, that approved of Gorbachev's new thinking, as he called it, which enabled him to move in that direction. Great people, great men in this case, can change the course of history, but it's also true that they need a constituency. And had that constituency not existed, had those Gorbachev fan clubs, in effect, in the West not existed, had that popular pressure not been there, I think Gorbachev could not have gone as far as he did. Furthermore, he got many of his key ideas, even that term new thinking, from the movement. That comes directly from a speech, an anti-nuclear speech, by Albert Einstein back in 1946.
There's an irony.
Right. And in the later 1950s, Russell Einstein statement on the nuclear arms race, Russell Einstein Manifesto, it's often called, they again bring up that idea that a new way of thinking is vital if humanity is to survive in this nuclear age. And so Gorbachev just took up that phrase, and he took up the ideas, and his key advisors took up the ideas. They were even more affected by the movement than he was, and they brought this home to him. And indeed, I was told by people who talked to some of his advisors and some of his speechwriters that they directly took his speeches from the anti-nuclear journals of the time. So I think, yes, Gorbachev was a great figure and deserves a good deal of credit because he could have moved along the lines that Brezhnev did and Chernenko did and so on. But instead, he chose to chart a new course for the Soviet Union and for the world. Should I move on to Reagan?
Certainly.
Because in certain ways, Reagan is a more complex figure. Reagan was not a man who was comfortable with the anti-nuclear movement. Reagan, only at his daughter's request, met with two of its leaders, Helen Caldicott and Harold Wilens, and both meetings were a disaster in many ways. There was just no meeting of minds. So Reagan was never a convert to the movement, as Gorbachev was. On the other hand, as I pointed out, Reagan felt the pressure from the movement. He felt this great groundswell of public sentiment, not just from the Freeze campaign, but from the polls that were constantly being reported to him by his favorite pollster, his White House pollster, Richard Werthelin, who helped to develop the Republican campaigns in 1980 and 1984, the two times Reagan won. And he was very conscious of public sentiment. And therefore, as a figure who had long been an actor, after all, a man who adapts himself to an audience, and after that had been a politician, again, a figure, as you know, as a person who covers politics, politicians also try to adapt to constituencies and what they want, Reagan began to shift. He was never comfortable with the movement, but he began to shift what he said and eventually began to view himself as a figure who would not get ready for nuclear war, as he was first talking about doing when he came to power in 1981, but as a figure who would help to lead humanity out from under the shadow of the bomb.
Now, aren't there, Larry, some people who would say to you, yeah, well, that was part of his grand plan all along. Be tough in the beginning, mm-hmm. You said peace through strength, and then achieve this magnificent goal of, you know, letting up a little bit. How do we know?
Well, we don't know for sure, but one would think that if that were true, we could find evidence that he was secretly planning to free humanity from the nuclear menace. But there's no sign of that in his record. There's no sign of that in his papers. There's no sign of that in the speeches of his circle, of his entourage. And by the way, I should add, when Reagan was elected, he appointed dozens of figures from a group called the Committee on the Present Danger, which was comprised of some of the leading hawks, including nuclear hawks, of the time. And these people, like Reagan, who also belonged to the Committee on the Present Danger, these people never talked about getting rid of nuclear weapons. And I defy people to find something in the Reagan record or the record of these other figures that actually talks about getting rid of nuclear weapons. None of them said that at the time.
Let me follow up with the Star Wars question.
Mm-hmm.
If, in fact, one was thinking about abolishing nuclear weapons, this sort of was a move in the other direction, wasn't it?
Well, it's a complicated question because Reagan viewed it as a means, as a kind of halfway course between the peace movement on the one hand that wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons and the hawks in his own administration that were talking about a nuclear buildup and waging nuclear war. So here was the solution. He could deal with the popular pressure, which was based on fear of nuclear war, by saying to people, well, we'll protect you from nuclear war by this invisible shield, and the bombs will never fall on the United States. And when some people said, well, that's a very one-sided way to handle things, and the Soviet Union said, well, this is silly. You're just getting ready for a first strike against us. You want this invisible shield of the United States while you launch your nuclear weapons against us. In fact, Gorbachev said that. Reagan said, well, we'll share it with the Soviet Union. Well, none of Reagan's advisors wanted to share it with the Soviet Union, and they never did so, I might add.
Well, never did so. We don't have it either. So
well, but we're building it, but we've never offered that. And indeed, in the early funding for it and so on, the Soviet Union was never in the loop for that. And Gorbachev just responded, this is total nonsense. And for years, this held up nuclear arms control agreements, till finally the peace movement put enough pressure on Gorbachev to get him to back away from Star Wars, from SDI, and to say, well, all right, it really doesn't matter. If you must build it, you do it. We're not going to worry about that now. What we do want to do is to get the nuclear missiles out of Western Europe, the intermediate range missiles, and we're going to do that. And the peace movement had convinced Gorbachev to ignore Star Wars because they told him, look, if we can have a disarmament agreement, if we can move toward detente once more with the Soviet Union, then Congress won't appropriate money for Star Wars. It won't be built. And indeed, until the Bush people got into power once more, it was not built. Oh, there were a few billion dollars thrown at and so on, but it got nowhere. The ABM treaty was not scrapped. And of course, that would have to be something to be scrapped if they were going to build it. So until the Bush people got into power, George W. Bush, Star Wars was a dead letter, and it looked like it was not going to be built. And this really frustrated the conservatives and the hawks in the GOP, who felt that Gorbachev had had his way, that the Reagan administration had been frustrated in their great dream of building this.